can buy me love, love, can buy me love. I'll buy you a diamond ring, my friend, if it makes you feel all right. I'll get you anything, my friend, if it makes you feel all right. 'Cause I don't care too much for money, but money can buy me love. I'll give you all I've got to give if you say you love me too. I may not have a lot to give, but what I got, I'll give to you. I don't care too much for money, but money can buy me love.
The song says money can't buy me love, but that's not really true. Fact is that the same market forces that drive our economy drive our search for love and sex. Issues like abundance, scarcity, the price of commodities like beer all contribute to who we choose and the success and failure of those relationships. We're going to talk about that today with my guest, Dr. Marina Adshade. She teaches economics at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Back in 2008, she launched an undergraduate course entitled Economics of Sex and Love. It's become one of the most popular courses at the university, and it is my pleasure to welcome her here today to talk about her book, Dollars and Sex, How Economics Influences Sex and Love. Marina Adshade, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here. How did this course initially get started? Tell us that. You were teaching economics and sort of had the idea for this as a way to better teach economics.
Yeah, you know, I've been teaching economics for years, and we teach students all the things that we teach undergraduate students. But I wanted to find a way to get students more engaged in understanding economics. And of course, what we teach them in their first couple of years of their undergraduate degree doesn't really fully encompass all the work that we do. So I wasn't the first one to say, let's take economics and apply it to marriage or apply it to dating, apply it to other types of relationships. So academic research has been doing this for years, but I brought all that material together and put it in an undergraduate course, so that students can take an economics course that they can actually apply to their own lives.
And one of the things that's so remarkable about this is how you can apply some basic ideas about economics and market forces to relationships, to dating, to sex, to love, and how those things are really pretty fundamental.
They are fundamental. I mean, you mentioned it in the introduction, but forces like abundance and scarcity that play such important roles on other markets, they play very similar roles on the markets for dating and marriage. I mean, I think that we all know that. Anybody who's single or has been single and searching knows that, you know, if they are the relatively scarce, you know, part of the market, that's going to drive up their value. Or if they're part of a more abundant part of the market, that's going to drive down their value. I think that we know this, and I certainly didn't invent the expression the meat market or the marriage market. I think that people know that they're operating on markets. But what I do is take that knowledge that we are operating on markets and give it a more solid framework so that we have ways of thinking about those markets, thinking about how the markets have changed in the last 30 or 40 years, and think about how those markets are going to change in the future, because those markets are being influenced by economic forces.
And in fact, they've changed dramatically, say, in the past 20 years. If you look at what was operative then and what's operative today, we see changes in the marketplace that have affected all of these things.
Yeah, you know, really, that's true. In 20 years, and the biggest change in the market in the last 20 years has been the increase in the number of educated women relative to the number of educated men. And that's had a big effect on the market since women have had to revise their expectations about who they're going to marry in terms of their education levels. Because, you know, in the U.S. today, for every 100 men that there is with a university degree of kind of marriageable age, men between the ages of like 25 and 40, there's 133 women with a college degree. That means that there's going to be a lot of women out there who have to revise their expectations about marriage in terms of marrying somebody who has the same education level as them. So that's one big, the big change. And then the second big change is really even more recent than the last 20 years. For the last 10 years is dating online, because that just completely changes the way that the market operates.
The other aspect is that it reflects the broader economy in terms of a decrease in social mobility. We find more and more people marrying people that are similar to them.
Yeah, that's a great point. And online dating is actually contributing to that, is that, you know, in the past, people had very small marriage markets that they operated on. And on small marriage markets, people put a lot less emphasis on finding somebody who's similar to them in terms of their income or their education level, because they have limited choices. Now that markets are so much bigger, I like to call them thicker markets, people look for longer because they're looking for people who are very similar to themselves. And that does affect the social structure of the economy when you have people who are, you know, the professionals who are the high income earners, all marrying other people like that. And that leaves the people who are less educated, lower income earners to marry each other. And so, definitely creating more of a class system when you have people marrying along those lines instead of across the lines.
One of the other things you talk about is that the advent of online dating has created more measurable metrics, more measurable criteria that people lay out for what they want. It's not as serendipitous as it once might have been.
Yeah, you know, if I was looking for somebody and I was at a dinner party and I met them, I would be looking for qualities that are more experiential about them. You know, the way they laughed or smiled, or, you know, the way they looked at me, conversations we might have about topics of the world. So that's a very different way of meeting, because I wouldn't meet somebody at a dinner party and then immediately say to them, you know, what is your income, education level, what are your political beliefs, religious views, you know, how many children do you want to have? Those things usually wait until later, until we have a solid impression of them. Online dating encourages people to look for measurable qualities. And more importantly, in terms of the way the market clears, it encourages people to limit the qualities that they're looking at. So I might meet somebody at a party who's, you know, an inch shorter than me, but that doesn't matter because they're just unbelievably charming. On an online dating site, people set their criteria and they don't look for those other things. They only look for the things that they can measure. And so people essentially limit their own markets. Even though the markets are very thick with online dating, people actually try pretty hard to keep their markets limited. And the new online dating websites we're getting now that use algorithms are just an attempt to try to subvert people's own behavior of limiting their markets to purely measurable qualities.
The other part of that question is whether or not people are honest about what it is that they say they want.
Yeah, you know, people are very concerned about dishonesty in online dating, and with a good reason, because people are dishonest in online dating all the time. I mean, I've actually done online dating. Well, I've never successfully done online dating, but online dating past where I was talking to somebody who told me that he had a graduate degree, and when pressed, he actually had spent like 3 years in community college and not finished any of his courses. And that was, as far as he was concerned, that was the equivalent of having a graduate degree. And people who do online dating, yeah, no, he said, I spent so much in school by that time, in school I could be a doctor by now, but it's like, but you're not a doctor, right? And people come across this all the time. And the thing is that, I mean, from my perspective, the reason why there is dishonesty online dating is not so much that people go into it with the intention of being dishonest. It's that people who stay on the market for longer, they start revising their profiles to make them seem more appealing. So, you know, maybe when I first put up a dating profile, I'm completely honest. But after a while, you know, I start shaving off a few pounds. I start taking off a couple inches because women actually apparently lie down about their height. I try to make myself more appealing on the market, and that's where the dishonesty comes in. It comes in over time as people try to increase their saleability on the market.
There are other metrics that you talk about within the context of the course and in the book, Dollars and Sex, metrics having to do with people's height, metrics having to do with looks versus dollars. Talk about some of those.
Mm. Yeah, you know, this is the thing about the online dating sites, is they provide us with this incredible wealth of data that we would have no other way of getting. So economists don't like to rely on people self-reporting their preferences, because when people self-report their preferences, they're often not very honest, either with the researchers or with themselves. it's much better for us if we can actually observe the market in action. And so online dating gives us an opportunity to do that because we can see people's profiles and the information about themselves, and then we can see who they contact. And so we can kind of get their preferences out about whom, in terms of what they're looking for in a mate by who they contact on the online dating sites. So one of the things that some really wonderful researchers have done, actually, Dan Ariely has done this work, and a lot of your listeners is probably familiar with Dan Ariely's work because he's written a number of books that are very popular in economics. But he, what they do is they look at the trade-off between income and good looks. And it's interesting because he can ask simple questions like, how much additional income would this woman have in order for you to encourage you to date her even if she's in the bottom 10th percentile in terms of her looks? Or would you do the same thing for men? If there's some guy who's in the bottom 10th percentile in terms of looks, how much would his income have to be for you to encourage you to want to date him equally to somebody who's in, the top 10th percentile? And the numbers are very large. And in fact, the number for men is infinity. There's no amount of money that will encourage men to date a woman who's in the bottom 10th percentile in terms of appearance, compared to having some woman who's in the top. Women are willing to make the trade-off, but the numbers are still pretty large. I can't remember the numbers in the book, but I think it's something like he has to have an additional $286,000 a year in income in order to encourage women to contact him on an online dating site.
One of the other aspects is the commodification of everything related to relationships, even right down to the price of beer and alcohol.
Yeah, you know, so the book's not all about dating and relationships. I talk about students and I talk about teen kind of more casual sexual behavior, and that's where the price of alcohol comes into, because it's interesting because when we look at the evidence, there is a relationship between taxes, for example, on alcohol, and the rate of STDs in society. And so that suggests that when we increased alcohol taxes, people consume less alcohol because they're responding to the higher price, and because they're consuming less alcohol, they engage in less risky sexual behavior. My students love this topic. This is a very popular topic for my class because this is the one area the students actually feel that they understand. They probably feel they understand it better than I do.
Talk a little bit about what the students say about all of this commodification and all of these metrics used in the context of relationships, whether they're cynical about it or whether there's an appreciation of it.
Yeah, you know, I meet with very little cynicism. When I first tell people say, as I say, I'm an economist, and I tell them that I work on the economics of sex and love, there's like a 15-second interval of skepticism that those two things are actually related to each other. But most people, I don't need to convince you, give them enough time, they will come up on their own question that might be answered using the economic framework. And so I don't meet with a lot of cynicism, and I definitely don't meet with a lot of cynicism from my students. They're actually very open to the idea that these relationships can be described within markets, and that these relationships can be measured. Now, there's other things they're skeptical about. They don't like, for example, when I show them data that says that university students are actually less sexually active than non-university students. They have a hard time buying that because they think that they're in this wonderland of relationships that is the university. They're skeptical of those things, but applying the market theory to it, no, they're not skeptical at all.
The other thing is that economic status plays such a large role in how people handle relationships, whether it be cheating or whether it be commitment or kids or anything else. Economic status seems to be a key indicator.
It does. You know, I think that the thing about it, well, first of all, in terms of cheating, I should say this, is that we have this perception that the biggest cheaters in the world are the wealthy men, because those are the stories that are reported on the media. We don't turn on our TV news to find out that, you know, some minimum wage earner has had an affair on his wife, and so that leaves us with the perception that those are the guys who are cheating, and that's not borne out in the data at all. So there's very little relationship for men between income status and cheating. There is for women, but it goes the opposite direction of what you might think. So women who have lower economic status are more likely to cheat in their marriages than women with higher economic status. But there is a relationship between power and cheating. And so powerful men and powerful women are both more likely to be unfaithful to their partners. But, you know, I think that one of the most interesting things about the idea about between economic status and your relationships, and it's not just infidelity, but it's, you know, ability to marry and so on, is that there is a possibility that people make their decisions about their economic status based on predictions about how they're going to do in the future. So, for example, I've already said that there's a real shortage of educated men as marriage partners in the U.S. today. Really what that should be doing is it should be encouraging younger men, and it should be encouraging parents to say to their boys, you know, I know that you don't want to go to university, but you might consider it as an option, not just because it's going to increase your income in the future, but because it's going to increase your ability to marry, and actually your ability to stay married, because people with university degrees have a significantly lower divorce rate than anybody else. So I won't rule out the possibility that people actually choose their economic status based on their expectations about how they're going to do in these markets, the markets for dating and marriage.
How much of looking at the economic overlay to all of this is simply an adjunct to what it would normally be the kind of evolutionary biological view of relationships?
Well, you know, so economists don't rule out preferences. And so our preferences really are driven by our biology. So we don't ignore biology. I don't ignore biology in the book, especially in the chapter on infidelity. I actually spend quite a bit of time talking about our biology because we want to talk about what the benefits to having relationships is. And the benefits are often very biological. So really what we do as economists is not that we ignore biology, and for the record, we don't ignore, you know, human emotions. We don't ignore, you know, the fact that people love each other. But really, we treat those as their preferences, just like we might talk about people's preferences for, you know, any products that you could buy on the market. And so we're not kind of extracting away from the biology, but we're really just looking at within the same framework, and that biology drives our preferences, but the market itself actually determines the decisions we eventually make.
And perhaps nowhere is that clearer than when you look at kind of friends with benefit relationships.
Ah, yes, the hooking up culture. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's the thing is that you know, one of the things about the friends with benefits and the general hooking up culture is that sure those decisions might be purely, you know, biological, you know, they're just purely based on lust, for example, but people's freedom to do that and people's willingness to engage in those relationships, those have economic explanations, and we know this because people weren't having these types of relationships 100 years ago or 50 years ago, and certainly not to the degree that they're having now. And there is an economic explanation for why these markets have changed and why people are more willing to act on those impulses now than they were in the past. And it has everything to do with the costs of having those relationships versus the benefits. The benefits are biological, for sure, but the costs are very economic. So, for example, the cost for a woman to becoming accidentally impregnated today when she's not married are very different than they were even 50 years ago. And those costs are related to the economy.
The other thing that we see is an increase in younger women, college students, hooking up with older, wealthier men.
Okay.
And that has an economic imperative as well.
Yeah, so you're talking about the sugar daddy phenomenon. That's been getting a lot of attention lately because one of the websites that actually helps makes these arrangements has said that there's an increase in supply of women on the market who are willing to do this, and the supply is measured by the number of people who sign up for their website. We actually don't know anything about the demand and how the demand has changed. I think that'd be very interesting to look at, especially given the current economic climate, because the number of men out there who have the extra funds to, say, spend $3,000 or $4,000 a month to have a university student as a girlfriend, it seems to me that it has got to have dwindled in recent years. But it is an interesting it's an interesting story, and I think that it actually has less to do with the cost of education, and it has more to do with the way that social norms are evolving over time to make these types of relationships less stigmatized than they were in the past, right? And, you know, it wasn't that long ago that a relationship like this would have been deemed completely socially unacceptable, and actually I don't think that they're considered socially acceptable now, but the stigma is greatly reduced. And so that means that the cost for doing it, for entering into these relationships for the young women, the university students, and actually there are young men on this market too, I should say, has fallen, and so it's encouraging more people to at least consider the possibility that they could work on this market for a short period of time while they're in school, so that they don't end up having as much student debt as they might have otherwise.
Again, the cost, the increasing cost of education coupled with other aspects of the marketplace really is what makes this market operate.
It does make this, it makes this market operate, and it's not just the increasing cost of education. I think that a lot of students' parents lost a lot of money in the last recession, so they might have arrived in their college years without having as much backing as they might have in better economic climates. They might have had, you know, the unemployment rate still very high for young people. So it's not even just the cost of education, but the people's means to fund those educations has diminished. So that's definitely going to be driving an increase in the supply of younger people who are willing to at least, you know, consider the possibility that this is the way they can make some money while they're in school.
Marina Adshade. The book is Dollars and Sex, How Economics Influences Sex and Love. Marina, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, it's been super. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.